Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Hi, I'm Hadassah Stein. I'm a graduate of SUNY Downstate and pursuing radiology. I serve on the JOMA Teen Health Committee and I'm an interviewer for the JOMA Specialty Spotlight Podcast. The Specialty Spotlight Podcasts are geared towards pre-med and medical students interested in learning about different medical specialties. Today, I'll be interviewing Dr. Zvi Jacob Schreiber. Zvi Schreiber, MD, is a GI pathologist and a director of CDX Diagnostics, an advanced diagnostic platform that leverages artificial intelligence enabled tissue analysis and 3D imaging to reliably detect precancerous cells. He received his undergraduate degree from Ner Yisrael, attended Yeshiva Baltimore, and got a bachelor's in Talmudic law. He completed his science prerequisites from Towson University and University of Maryland. He did his residency in pathology at Stony Brook University and a fellowship in surgical pathology at Columbia. He has held academic appointments at Columbia University and SUNY Downstate. Hello, Dr. Schreiber.
Hello, nice to meet you.
So our first question, why did you choose a career in medicine and what characteristics make one a good fit for a career in medicine?
I think for me, it was kind of a boring story. I was always good at science and things like that. And the idea of helping people was appealing. So it's kind of natural to end up in a career in medicine. I also kind of thought this might be a little controversial, but I always thought, you could do it's a good profession to do, and you could be honest and make a decent salary, have an honest job, as opposed to other things. So the temptation to be dishonest is not there. So science, helping people, kind of was obvious to do medicine. Characteristics of people to go into medicine, I don't think there are any. I think there's so many different specialties, so many different types of things that you could do that as long as you have the interest in doing any of the fields of medicine, I think you could manage and do it. Most people are innately good people. So I think that just it's something people will, any kind of personality or would fit into medicine. Yeah. I don't know what made you do medicine. I guess it's not an interview for you, but it's that kind of that kind of idea. You think you have characteristics that are so special for medicine? No, I think most people could find a way to end up doing medicine. Any of the fields they could choose.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a basic you have to like the sciences. You have to kind of be studious, not hate looking at the books.
Yeah, of course.
And it is a clear path in that I think, if you work hard, you will probably succeed. But I do agree that there's so many different personalities that made up my class. And that becomes very apparent during third year when you find what area fits you most.
Exactly. Yes.
So for you, you chose pathology and
yes.
Walk us through a typical day for you as a pathologist and tell us why you decided to go into the field of pathology.
Sure. It's actually, there's a lot of different settings one could be a pathologist. You have academic settings, you have hospital settings, you have commercial laboratory settings. I happen to be working now in a commercial laboratory setting. I could give you a little bit of an idea of all the three types of settings that are available. Pathology is a little different than other specialties. Most specialties are associated with the hospital, academics or non-academics, and there's some commercial work, but very little. In pathology, I would say a good percentage, I would say probably half of pathologists out there are working in commercial laboratories. When I say a commercial laboratory, I refer to things like Quest or LabCorp. Those are kind of labs that you've heard of. BioReference. Those are so a lot of pathologists work in these commercial labs. that are not associated with hospitals. So just to start from the beginning, if you work in an academic type of hospital, you're involved in hospital service, from surgeries to just biopsies and all that. The more academic you are, the more research oriented the position is, the more interaction you have with surgeons and different departments and things of that sort. If you work in a community hospital, you have less research, less kind of, you still have the interaction with the clinicians, but it's much, much less academic, much less research oriented. It's more service work, specimens that come in, you diagnose the specimens, and then you go home. There is call, very little call in a community hospital. The bigger the hospital, the more call you could have. Things that you get called for are like for a frozen section. I don't know if you know what a frozen section is. Have you heard that before? So frozen section is something that, let's say, a patient comes in and is having a surgery done, and often, more often than not, it's associated with cancer. So they get in there, they see something, they need a diagnosis within 20 minutes to know, do I continue the surgery? Do I continue the surgery further? Things of that sort. So you have to be in-house in the hospital at those times. They'll send you a specimen, a biopsy, and then you freeze it. That's what's called the frozen section, as opposed to the normal way you process it. And you make a slide out of it, you take a look, and you give a preliminary diagnosis. And based on your diagnosis, the surgeon will either continue or stop. Or, I mean, there's a lot of variables depending on the procedure you're doing. So those are things that you have to be on call for. Most of the time, these are scheduled surgeries, but every so often, these are unscheduled surgeries. So then someone has to be on call. And even in a community small hospital, these things happen. So again, the smaller the hospital, if it's not a cancer center, you get very few of these on a regular basis. So even if you're on call for, you take a week at a time call, you maybe never get called, right? If you're working in a big academic hospital, like in the city, Columbia, a Cornell, associated with big cancer centers, there's Sloan Kettering, all these type of places have 20, 30, 40 frozens a day, right? And they can continue till 8 o'clock. So then, in the evening late. So then you are busy when you're on call those days for the frozen section. So that's only really in big academic and cancer centers. When you're in a community hospital, very little call. When you're in a commercial lab, all you're doing, you have almost no association with the hospital. You're getting specimens from the community, and in the lab, we'll get into the types of specimens you get. You process the specimens, diagnose, and you go home. So most of these things are like 9-to-5 jobs. There's no call. Every so often the doctor calls you with a question or whatever. So you have to be available to answer, but it doesn't have to be off hours. It's usually a 9-to-5 type of job. In the hospitals, it's not always 9-to-5. That really depends on which type of hospital you're in. It varies from hospital to hospital.
What route did you take?
So right now I'm in a commercial lab. Sometimes you don't really choose where you end up, and life chooses things for you. I started out in, doing residency fellowships in academic places. My first job was in an academic type place that had fellows, not really super academic, but had a couple of fellows to train. So it was at a community hospital with fellows. So it was a hybrid academic community hospital. I worked in Staten Island University Hospital. And then after worked there for a few years, I wanted to move on, and you kind of just take what presents itself at that moment. And then life took me into the commercial pathology world, which, like I said, I would say a good 50%. I mean, maybe my numbers are not exact, but at least 40 to 50% of pathologists are working in commercial type settings and not in hospitals.
Well, definitely.
So I currently work in a commercial lab, mostly GI pathology associated, which we'll get into a little bit. But so like I said, it's mostly 9-to-5 type work, very low stress type when it comes to ideas of call and weekend and Shabbos, and all these issues are almost non-existent.
Yeah, it seems like a good quality of life and work-life balance option.
Yes. I mean, if you do want to stay in a really high pressure academic setting, then those things are not as the work-life balance isn't as great. If you were in, you know, if you're in Harvard and they require you to do all this research and all this service work and all, it is a lot more pressure, and maybe relative to other fields, it's still less pressure, but relative to a commercial lab job, the pressure is much more.
Yeah. And also this idea of a frozen section and needing like that real-time feedback is new to me.
Yeah, so I think, you know, some med students would have gotten exposed to that doing their surgery rotations. Depending what surgery type of rotation you did, is more prone to frozen section than others. So if you did a cardiothoracic surgery, for example, you probably don't have. I mean, maybe you have some with the lungs, but if you're doing hernia surgeries and you're not getting too many. You do if you're involved with cancer surgeries, then you can, you know, even like you know, breast surgeons, urologists, they're often sending for frozen sections. You know, lymph nodes, sentinel lymph nodes, things like that, often need you know, that always changes from year to year, the recommendations, but things like that. So it really depends on what you rotated through in surgery. If you had that exposure,
definitely makes sense. Yes. So our next question, what distinguishes anatomic and clinical pathology, and how do these training focuses practically differ?
Right. So most pathologists, you know, when they finish medical school, they'll go into residency. It's most programs are anatomic pathology and clinical pathology combined. There are some people that will say that know in advance, I only want to do anatomic and I only want to do clinical. So, but those are generally more research oriented, more, you know, more unusual. You have to really have specific interests. So generally anatomic pathology it encompasses like surgical pathology. That's like anything that comes out of the body from a surgery or biopsies, specimens, cytology. That's more of the fluids like CSF, urine, pap smears, that's cytology. So when the preparation is made, it's more of like a cell preparation that's full cells that are kind of suspended in fluid, as opposed to other preparations are slices of the tissue in surgical pathology. And also autopsy pathology is associated in anatomic, in AP and anatomic pathology. Clinical pathology is what you think of more when you do a blood test. So the blood tests go to the lab, hematology, chemistry, microbiology, et cetera. All of those things are under the categories of clinical pathology. So most pathologists get trained in both. When you do a residency, it's generally a 4-year residency. You do 2 years of, on average, you know, you could have some electives and things like that and some carryover, but 2 years of anatomic pathology, 2 years of clinical pathology. So when you come out of residency, you're qualified to run a lab that does all of these types of tests. In reality, though, most people do the 4-year residency, and then most people do one fellowship or even two fellowships. And there's so many different fellowships available in pathology that it's almost a little bit dizzying. But there are many fellowships that are a boarded fellowship that have a board that you take at the end of the fellowship, and there are many that are not boarded fellowships. So as for example, in anatomic pathology, cytology, forensic pathologies like autopsy pathology, dermatopathology, those are boarded fellowships. But if you want to do GI, breast, GYN, head and neck, I don't know, any kind of sub-organ system, there are fellowships available for that, but they're not boarded. And often there are people that just develop the interest through their career, even if they didn't do a fellowship. For example, let's say in GI, you do a fellowship in whatever in GI, so you're a GI pathologist, or you do a surgical pathology fellowship. And then throughout your career, you develop the interest in GI and you focus on GI. Now I'm a GI pathologist because I said so, right? Not so much because you're boarded. But the other boarded fellowships, you are a forensic pathologist because you did the forensic pathology fellowship, and then you took the boards and you passed it. If you in the clinical pathology, You have heme path, like hematopathology. That's, you know, bone marrows and lymphoma and stuff like that. You have that's boarded. You have cytogenetics that's boarded. You have molecular pathology that's boarded. That's like tests that, I don't know how much detail you want to go into, but tests that use PCR. And now everybody knows what PCR is with COVID. But before that, you know, you'll do Western blots, Southern blots, PCR, these kind of molecular tests. And cytogenetics are like the chromosome. When you see the karyotype, you see the XY, XX, and you see all those 46 chromosomes. And then also blood bank is a clinical pathology subspecialty. So the blood bank in a hospital is also run by a pathologist. And generally, it's a fellowship-trained pathologist in blood bank. But a lot of people, like I said, are specialized in these sub-organ systems that are not boarded, and they just kind of, you do a fellowship or a partial fellowship, and then you do research in that field, and you focus on that through your career, and you develop an interest, and then you call yourself whatever subspecialty you want to do, like a, you know, a GYN, GI, whatever, head and neck pathologist, things like that. It really, if you add them up, it's probably over 20 different fellowships, sub names or sub titles of subspecialties of fellowships out there. And then you have some fellowships that kind of overlap with other specialties. So like dermatopathology, you could get into dermatopathology from the pathology route, or you could be a dermatologist and then do a dermatopathology fellowship, which is kind of interesting. So you're competing with other specialties sometimes for certain fellowships. Similarly, blood bank, you could be a hematology oncologist and kind of do blood bank. So these are kind of unique ways about it. So if you were a person in medical school that had some, I don't know, innate interest in molecular pathology, you could choose to do a clinical pathology residency only. So instead of being 4 years, it's 3 years, and you don't do any of the anatomics. So you're only boarded in clinical pathology, and then you go into molecular pathology fellowship, and that's what you want to do in life. But the vast majority of pathologists don't do that because it's 1 year more, and then you get both anatomic and clinical. And it happens to be in the market, the job market, there's many more positions available for anatomic pathology than for clinical pathology. You could run a lab that does millions and millions of blood tests, and you have one pathologist doing it because you have techs that do a lot of the stuff. It's a lot of automation, computer machinery, and you know, that does a lot. So you only need one director that can run a huge lab. But when it comes to biopsies and things of that sort, you physically have to look at a microscope and diagnose. And there's only so many a person can do in a day. You know, you're only human, so you only do so many. So there are many more positions are filled but in anatomic pathology compared to the clinical pathology field. What's different than let's say radiology, there's no preliminary year. So you go straight from medical school and you graduate, and you don't do that prelim medicine or whatever surgery that you're kind of stuck with as a radiologist or others, or even like a, you know, anesthesiologist or whatever. Many years ago, we did have to do that, like I would say in the 90s and the early 2000s, they changed it and they got rid of it. And so it's directly from medical school into residency, 4 years of APCP.
Yeah, that's a perk. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting perk. Yes. It's interesting because when they changed this is maybe not kind of a little bit off topic. When it was required, so most people did the 1+4, so it's a 5-year residency. Once they took away the requirement, they didn't add a year to pathology. They just said, okay, 4 is enough, right? So they had that 1 or 2 years of transition. They had 2 or 3 graduating classes the same year, you know, 2 classes graduating residency the same year. So then people got always in a panic. Oh my gosh, how am I going to get a job? There's so many people. So then people started doing all these fellowships. So then now it's become the norm that everybody does at least one fellowship, you know, to be competitive for a job. Even though now the job market is really there's a shortage of pathologists. So So you probably don't need to do a fellowship, but now it's kind of expected because I did a fellowship. So you have to do that. You're not good enough, you know, if you didn't do a fellowship, you know. It's kind of that attitude, which is probably not correct, but it is customary now. Most people do one or two fellowships even. They'll do, let's say, a surgical pathology fellowship, and then that's a kind of a general fellowship, and then they'll do a subspecialty like GI or GYN or whatever. I want to do GI pathology. So which is kind of interesting because in community hospitals, right, you don't have the luxury to do that. So you know, let's say a medium-sized hospital, I don't know what kind of hospital you want to discuss, but a small community hospital, even a 500-bed hospital, could have four pathologists, and that's it. So that's the whole staff. So then you don't have the luxury to say, I only do GI pathology. Right, who's going to do the rest of this stuff? Right, I don't have, you know, I'm only going to do GYN, so that doesn't work. So, but if you work in a big academic place like Sloan Kettering, Columbia, you know, Columbia, well, Columbia is kind of a hybrid, but you know, Cornell, you have pathologists that only do their subspecialty. So you'll have, you know, the GI team, the GYN team, the breast team, the head and neck team, the neuropath team, the derm path team, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so then what ends up happening is that people forget what other things look like. So you get a specimen that's not, now you get a GI biopsy, but it's a met from somewhere else. And you completely forget, oh, one second, this kind of doesn't look like a GI primary tumor. Maybe it's a metastatic lung cancer. It's like, oh, how do you work that up again? And you completely forget. So the holistic pathologist is kind of disappearing. I don't know if, you know, people will say it's better, people will say it's worse. I don't, I think there's a negative to it. You know, every place that every kind of academic place always has the senior pathologist in the group that knows everything, because when he was practicing, he did everything. And now you get a specimen in your head and neck department. Now, I don't know what this is. You show it to the old guy, and he's like, "Of course, this is what it is." And you're like, "Well, because I haven't seen that in 5 years." Well, yeah, because you haven't been doing it. So that's kind of a negative. And those people are all going to retire soon. So if not retired already. So I think in academics, you kind of have that fear. And then in the community hospitals, you still have the generalists, and then in the commercial places, it's back again to subspecialty. So the commercial places are more kind of, you're not getting big specimens like a big surgery, like a Whipple. You know what a Whipple is? I mean, I don't know if you know what that is. Yeah. So you're not getting these big colectomies, Whipples. You're only getting mostly biopsies. So it's you know, GI, GYN, you know, like pap smears, you know, GI biopsies, colonoscopies, endoscopies. You're getting skin biopsies. You're getting some breast biopsies. And then you don't see everything else. But then you only, so then you could say, I'm only doing the GI, I'm only going to do the GYN or things like that. Or I'm only going to do the cytology, the urine, the pap smears, and the thyroid FNAs, and that's it. Right? So we are becoming subspecialized to the point that you kind of aren't forgetting everything you learned before. So.
Yeah, no, that is interesting because I think people like they like this idea of someone becoming super good at just one thing, but yeah, you're losing that big picture.
It really is a balance, and I'm sure it's similar in radiology. You could do, you know, neuroradiology or pediatrics or whatever, and then what happens if you get a 18-year-old? It's not so pediatrics anymore. Then you forgot everything when an adult has and whatever. So anyway, but I think that's happening in a lot of fields in medicine.
Yeah, no, radiology, the norm I think now is that most people do fellowships.
Right.
And I think it's kind of become what you're saying, that the radiology some of the radiology attendings have to walk across the hall and be like, I don't know what this
I don't know what this
is.
is.
Not my
Right, right,
anatomic area.
right. Right. I'm only a left toe pathologist, radiologist. And I don't know what the right toe shows. Right. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
They're very good at reading the left toe, so.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Our next question, what sort of specimens and examinations do you encounter as a GI pathologist?
Right. So I kind of touched upon this before, but so a GI pathology in a commercial environment is mostly from colonoscopies and endoscopies that people are getting outpatient. And then the GI doctor does biopsies, and then, you know, so it's really, you know, esophagus, stomach, and colon, some small bowel. If you're in a hospital setting, GI also includes the surgical specimens that include, you know, if you have colectomy, small bowel surgeries, stomach resections, liver, pancreas, those kind of things. That's what a GI pathologist is mostly busy with. And so in the hospital, you could have the biopsies of all those organs, and the, well, you know, you don't really biopsy a pancreas, but in the commercial setting, you only really have the outpatient type biopsies. So you don't even get a liver biopsy in a commercial setting most of the time, because most of those patients are inpatient, they're sicker, and they, you know, you need fluoro and all that kind of stuff to get a good liver biopsy. So those are mostly done inpatient. So the commercial setting doesn't deal with even liver biopsy. So the commercial is just colonoscopy, endoscopy specimens.
So our next question, you are director at CDX Diagnostics. Can you tell us more about this company and the technology? How did you get involved, and how do you think pathology practice will evolve as new technology is developed?
So CDX is actually an interesting lab that started a good few years back. The idea started actually with oral pathology. So this lab that they came up with, they developed a specific brush that were able to take specimens in the mouth, as opposed to having to do actually a real complete biopsy. So, you know, like a resection. So a dentist would see the display, see something funny looking, you brush it. It's a cytology type of specimen, right? Meaning like a liquid suspension of cells, and right. And we could detect dysplasia or not, and then give the dentist a little bit of guidance of what they should do with regard to either continuing care or letting the patient go. Later on, we discovered that this brush is useful in other settings. So one of the main setting we use it for is for Barrett's esophagus. I don't know, are you familiar with Barrett's esophagus? So Barrett's esophagus has to do with reflux. You get this intestinal metaplasia of the squamous columnar junction, right? And that's a precancerous lesion, and it progresses to esophageal cancer. You know, you have low grade, high grade dysplasias, and invasive carcinomas. Okay, so currently the gold standard is an endoscopy. You do a regular biopsy, and you hope for the best. So really, the GI doctors will admit to you that a lot of times they're there at the GE junction, they're not sure what they're looking at, they just biopsy randomly. And even when they think they know what they're looking at, they only biopsy a small, it's only one little forceps biopsy, it's a small area. So we developed this brush that kind of samples the entire circumference of the GE junction. So we get a lot more tissue. And because of that, we have a much better chance of catching the Barrett's, and then progressively the low grades and high grade dysplasias. We also use a technology that's new, relative new, and this is a kind of very much in vogue these days. We scan the images, we digitally scan them, and, you know, we take pictures of them, you know, with a microscope and then with a camera, right? And then we come up with a digital image, and we use a artificial, you know, AI type of neural network to help present to the pathologist which zones of the slide are higher potentially a higher risk of this part could be dysplasia versus this part. You know, it's very much in vogue to do this AI business. It's not, you know, AI, even whoever says that AI is not really AI, what you think in science fiction, it's more kind of computer learning. And so what we do is creating, we created databases of images, you know, all these libraries of images, and we categorize them so that the computer helps you do the image analyzation based on what information it had before. So this test happens to be, we're the only ones that do it in the world. We find and that sounds like an advertisement for the lab now, we find a significant percentage more Barrett's and dysplasias than the traditional biopsy. We're currently in many different studies right now with NIH grants and all these different things to try to create this to be a standard of care in the future. So to answer the second part of your question, we are setting up the lab in a way that every single slide gets digitally scanned, and we have an image for every slide, and we create our own like information system of how to present the images online for people to see, which has not really been available yet. So I know when you compare it to radiology, radiologists have been looking at x-rays remotely on computers for, I don't know, 20 years. I don't know, you correct me, whatever, how long it is. The difference with pathology is if you've sat at a microscope, right, you are looking routinely at slides at 400 times magnification, right? So to scan a slide, there's thousands of fields per slide. The image files are huge. So part of the limitations of the technology that we have even until today is the file size and the time it takes to actually scan the slide. So all of those things are progressively getting easier. You know, computers are getting more, you know, more advanced to process all this image, to render the images for you on your computer and all these different things. So there's no doubt we are headed that route, that everything will probably be digitally scanned and available to be done remotely or whatever, presented on a computer as opposed to the microscope. Nonetheless, the optics on a cheap microscope are still much better than the optics of any camera that's really readily available to scan a slide on a routine basis. So are we there yet? No. Am I naive to say that eventually we'll get there? Of course we'll get there. How long it'll be to get to the point that every slide gets digitized? I'm not sure. That's, you know, it could be within 5 years, could be more. I don't know. It's hard to say, because even your home computer or your workstation at a hospital may not be strong enough to handle some of these huge files to render fast enough for it to be worth it. Then it's for it to be faster than you looking at the scope manually. I could sometimes look at a slide and 2-3 seconds I'm done. I look at the next one and I'm still waiting for the image file to download for the digital slide. So that's the challenges that we have. So part of what we're doing in the lab is creating this artificial intelligence to help you present the only parts of the image, not the whole thing, so only the areas of interest. And the other areas are available to you only if you kind of want to see it and things like that. Of course, that's not FDA approved yet, but we're in the process of all that progression. But I think we'll get there in the future. I think it'd be naive to say that we won't get to be to the point to digitize. Additionally, we store all the slides, you know, all these regulations from different states. All the slides have to be stored. They're a legal record of the patient, basically. So they have to be stored. So if you're able to digitize them appropriately, you could save physical space and you could, you know, discard the slide. So there's no question we'll get to that point. I don't know when.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be amazing to have all that digitalized images online. Makes it much, much more convenient for everyone. Do you think that having all those digitalized images so readily available will like speed up the process of machine learning and some of the other things that you were working on?
So potentially, you know, the more images a digital library has, the more it has what to compare to. It's the computer. So then the more accurate it could become. So then people say, well, then you're going to, the computer's going to take over your job, right? So I guess that's always a possibility, but the computers are nowhere near that level of, I mean, it's like dramatically far from that point that, and we're doing it only with one test type. So you would have to do this with every test type of every type of biopsy out there. And besides the monumental amount of work that is, it's still, I mean, I can't imagine it'll get to that point that the computer is more advanced than the human brain in recognizing different things. And you can think about it yourself. You know, if you see somebody, a friend of yours, you know, or an acquaintance, you're walking on the street, you see them, you know, far away from you, you kind of know who they are by the kind of their shape, the way they walk, and all these different characteristics. A biopsy has a million more characteristics than that. So it becomes way, way more complex than that. And nevertheless, the human brain is able to process that information after seeing so many cases in training and residency and your experience throughout your career, that you're able to come up with a diagnosis pretty quickly. Computers today are still having a hard time recognizing what's a cat and what's a dog. So, and this is, you know, AI experts will tell you, oh no, they can recognize. In reality, it may be able to tell you it's a cat or a dog, but it won't tell you what the subbreed of the dog. Absolutely not. If this is a Doberman or a German Shepherd or whatever. So it will we get to that point? I mean, I guess it's potentially, it's a potential fear that pathologists have that AI is going to take over our lives. But if it takes over our lives in pathology, it'll take over our life and everything else. And then nobody has a job, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going for radiology now with the whole like ChatGPT. It's everything you're reading in the news. So of course, the second question I get after I'm going for radiology is everybody's like, you know, what do you think about AI taking over your job? I never appreciate that comment. I'm just going to put it out there. But I do read up a lot on it. Yeah, I mean, the thing is like AI is kind of being integrated in all areas of medicine, really. So I think medicine is going to change a lot, like in all areas. But these are kind of the forefront because it's easiest, well, I guess.
I think AI will help a lot more when it comes to, let's say, medicine, and you have all these checklists and all these things that, oh, did you ask the patient about this? Did you, does this patient get this vaccine? All these things, different things. So the AI is there to point out you forgot this, you forgot that, those kind of things. When it comes to the more complex, you think a machine's going to do surgery for you. I mean, there's a certain art to it. You know, now you do have machines that help, like, you know, these Da Vinci machines and all these different things. But nevertheless, it's still the art of the doctor doing the procedure or the diagnosing, the CAT scan, MRI, or the biopsy. You know, maybe I'm naive, but I can't, it's hard to imagine that we'll get to that point so quickly. Because even the AI that we're doing, it's painstaking, and it's not perfectly effective. I mean, it often misses things still. I mean, we're still working on it, making it better and all that. But AI really is a misnomer. When we think of AI, we think of science fiction as like the robots thinking on their own. The AI that we have today is just pattern recognition and computer learning. It's not really thinking. If that makes, I don't know if I explained that well, but it's not nowhere near the level of having a robot walk on its own and have ideas and have thoughts. It's way, way far from that. So they just like to put the words AI because it sounds cool and it's marketing. You know, it's a marketing team that puts these buzzwords on things.
Yeah. And I think you really like touched on something by the art of medicine. Like a lot of it is not, I think, so neatly shaped, and there's a lot of things that have, you know, ambiguity and needs a human.
Yes, for sure. Like, I mean, I can't tell you how many, let's say, colon biopsies I've seen in my life. I mean, it's probably hard to count. It's probably over 100,000, right? And every single one looks different than the other, right? Nevertheless, they have similar characteristics that, with the art and the practice, you could say, well, this fits into these categories, but it often you have things that are blurring the lines between categories, and the experience and the art that you've built throughout the years helps you put it into the appropriate category. Appropriate, and you know, every once in a while you don't know the answer, right? Sometimes you say, I don't know, right? That happens every so often in pathology, you know, not too often. I mean, but every so often that happens, and it's like, okay, so then you need more tissue, or you need to do another biopsy or whatever. But But just that the thousands of biopsies that I've seen of the stomach, of the whatever, you know, and none of them are the same. It's never an exact replica. So there's so much variability that it's hard to imagine the AI be able to pick it up, because when there's one variable that changes, it completely throws it off off its algorithm, and then it's like, oh, this is a little different. I don't know what to do now. So it tries to do the best it can, and then it gets stuck in the way. So anyway.
Yeah. I do think that variability is kind of beautiful.
Yes.
So our next question, if you can go back in time, given the experience and perspective you have now, is there anything you would have done differently?
That's a really difficult question, because, you know, we believe, you know, you have Siyata Deshmaya that led you down this path. No pun intended, that led you down this road that you're in. And if you would have done things differently, would have it turned out better? Would it turned out worse? I don't know. I'll tell you, at one point in my residency, I was interested in doing dermatopathology. I was trying to consider to do that as a fellowship. And it didn't work out. And you know, I look back and I see now that a lot of dermatopathologists don't have jobs or whatever. It's like, oh, Baruch Hashem, you know? So at the moment you think, oh my God, it's the end of the world because I didn't get what I want. But then when you look back 10 years later, you're like, oh no, this is a much better, pathway in career. So it's hard to say, to look back and say, oh, I made a mistake. You know, I probably did many mistakes, but nevertheless, you know, you have Siyata Deshmaya that guides you to where you end up. So kind of hard to say you have regrets.
That seems like a very healthy perspective. And it's true. I think like everything along the way was meant to be.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think when I started pathology residency, I was going to end up in a commercial laboratory setting that does AI and kind of an experimental type test that nobody else in the world is doing. No, I thought I was going to work in an academic place doing research and whatever. And then life takes you on a path that you can't always control. So you have to just have a emunah and bitachon that you're going the right way. So and you hope for the best.
It's true. It's all we can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Our last question, what advice would you like to leave the pre-med and medical students listening to this podcast with?
Oh boy. So basically, you know, I would say, you know, when you're choosing a specialty, I could sit here and tell you, oh, any specialty you choose, oh, it's terrible because this and this. Oh, it's wonderful because this and this. So you really, you have to think of something that you like, and there's going to be negatives and positives of any specialty that you choose. I, of course, am partial to what I do. I think pathology is a great field. I think it's often overlooked for many reasons. You know, you have the stereotype that pathologist is the guy, the weirdo in the basement that is eating a sandwich over the autopsy. So, you think that's a pathologist. When in reality, I haven't done an autopsy or been involved in an autopsy in more than 10 years. So more than that. So it really is almost insignificant part of pathology, unless that's what you want to do when you do forensics. Nevertheless, it's an overlooked field. I think the medical schools don't present it well. And I think when you're doing rotations, even in specialties that rely a lot on pathology, like oncology, surgery, they don't really understand what we do. So then they don't even know how to explain it to you. And then they'll say, to even tell you, go check it out. And it's often overlooked. And I think it's a shame, you know, it has a very good work-life balance. You know, you could work part-time, you could work full-time, you could really, you know, push hard and do and work a lot in either in the academic or in the commercial setting. Or you could say, you know, at this point in my life, I want to back off. I want to work more part-time and still do okay. So it's something that's very overlooked, I think. And you know, I was a little lucky in my medical school that I had the teacher that taught the pathology course was an excellent teacher. And he kind of always pushed this idea, come to the lab, come check it out. And at one point I actually did. So then, oh, you know, this is pretty cool. This is interesting. So a lot of medical schools don't have that. And And I think that's a disservice. Nevertheless, you got to pick something that you like and something you're interested in. All the specialties have ebbs and flows, and you know, it's competitive now, it's not competitive tomorrow, and making a lot of money now, not making a lot of money tomorrow. So you know, all these kind of issues that you think are so important in making the decision often turn out not to be exactly how you imagined. So you have to do at least somewhat where you have to pick a specialty that you do have at least a good amount of interest and enjoy doing, at least now. You know, you know, I have people asking me all the time, it's like, isn't it boring to just look at biopsies all day? So then I ask them, well, you know, is it boring to look at x-rays all day? Is it boring to just pull out gallbladders all day? So it's the same thing, you know, basically any job you do become repetitive. And if you quote unquote get burnt out and you're bored, and you're bored. So, but it doesn't, there's no reason why pathology is more than that, more, causes more burnout than other jobs. So that's a faulty reason to overlook pathology. You know, is the bus driver so happy with his job? No, it's a job, you know, but you know, so you have to look at it a little bit that way. But in general, you should choose something that you like. And then your path will open up for you, you know, and it'll turn out probably very different than you can imagine. But you should always start out with something that you like.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Also, you know, you say like, unfortunately, pathology does get a bad rep. And I think that you have to be true to yourself and like not be listening to the expectations of the people around you. So if you like something and you find it fun, like, you know, don't listen to all the stereotypes because it's your life at the end of the day.
That's exactly right. The most common comment I got from my attendings in medical schools and doing you know, doing medicine or whatever, and once I already, let's say, what disclosed that I'm doing pathology, they're like, why would you do that? You're so personable. Why would you do that? Why would you want to do that? That's all these comments. And then I think to myself now, looking back, it's like, you're working twice as hard as I am, right? You're stressing out and all these different things, and I'm involved in thousands more patients than he'll ever be, and I affect more people's lives than he'll ever affect, as in just myself. And I'm not the busiest pathologist in the world, and I kind of laugh at him. Why would you do medicine? I can make the same comment for any other specialty, you know, not to degrade medicine, but you could look down at any specialty in medicine and say, why would you do that? So I think it's a little short-sighted.
Yeah. And then also you were saying, I guess, like, you know, everybody ends up kind of doing the same thing every day. I'll sometimes say to someone like, oh my God, you're going OB. That's so much work. And they're like, you're going for radiology. Like, you're going to be working hard too. But for me, that's less work because I'm actually enjoying it. So it makes it like, you know, less of a grind if you're enjoying the day-to-day. Oh.
Well, I think that's the case with any job you choose, not only medicine. If you really hate what you're doing, if you're not a good, you know, you don't like math and you ended up becoming an accountant, it's like, why would you do that to yourself, right? But so if you're not happy being OB, then yeah, why would you do that yourself? If you really like OB, then you're able to tolerate the negatives. That's the same thing with every specialty. If you like what you're doing, you're able to tolerate and maybe disregard the negatives of that field easier than if you're really unhappy with what you're doing, and you know, overall. And then when you're unhappy and then you have all this stuff that you have to deal with that's the negative of the field, it really starts killing you. So you have to choose what you like.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. This was extremely informative, really interesting. I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. I hope it was clear. I hope it you know, would encourage people to at least, you know, go to the basement and take a look at what's going on down there.
Definitely.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's J-O-W-M-A.org, or email us at health@joma.org.